VOA News, I'm David Berg. The United States is taking responsibility for a missile attack that killed top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani and the deputy head of Iraq's Hashad al-Sha'abi military at Baghdad's airport early Friday. The Pentagon said President Donald Trump had ordered the attack and U.S. forces carried it out to deter future Iranian attack plans in Iraq. President Trump tweeted a photograph of the American flag. Iraqi state TV reported Soleimani's death in a breaking news alert, citing sources from the Hashad, which is dominated by Shiite-majority factions close to Tehran. A Hashad spokesman said the airport attack also killed Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, a deputy commander of the Iranian-backed militias known as the Popular Mobilization Forces. The attack came amid tensions with the United States after a New Year's Eve attack by Iranian-backed militias on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. The White House said President Trump warned Turkey's president Thursday that outsiders were complicating the situation in Libya. Emer McCarthy has more.
President Tayyip Erdogan said last week that Turkey would deploy troops in Libya to support the internationally recognized government of national accord. The GNA last month requested Turkish support as it fends off an offensive by General Khalifa Haftar's forces to the east of the country. His forces are backed by Russia, Egypt, the UAE, and Jordan. The bill, which was opposed by all major opposition parties in the parliament, passed by 315 to 184 votes. Opposition parties said such a move could exacerbate conflicts in Libya and endanger Turkish soldiers in the region and Turkey's national security.
This is VOA News. A state of emergency is underway in New South Wales, and Victoria State has declared a state of disaster as Australia continues to battle deadly bushfires. As Phil Mercer reports, thousands of vacationers and residents have been ordered to leave the area.
The mass exodus from southern New South Wales is underway. The authorities are urging tourists and residents to leave while they can. More dangerous bushfire conditions are forecast for southeastern Australia in the days ahead. Authorities are extending the evacuation zone in New South Wales, the nation's most populous state, to include more areas of bushland and national park. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
North Korea's Kim Jong-un has been spotted riding his white horse into the mountains once again. As Reuters' Lauren Anthony reports, similar trips have preceded major policy decisions, and experts think 2020 could herald a return to long-range missile launches.
Kim says North Korea has a new strategic weapon and insists there is no longer reason for Pyongyang to be bound by a self-imposed suspension on nuclear and intercontinental ballistic missile tests. The strongest indication yet that the North could resume the major testing it suspended over 2 years ago in the run-up to diplomacy talks with the US. US military officials say they see a long-range missile launch as one of the most likely options. Others suggest the North could launch a satellite, deploy the new ballistic missile submarine it claims to be developing, or field a new domestically produced transporter erector launcher, basically vehicles for its largest missiles. Its plans could also involve mass-producing more weapons.
That's Lauren Anthony reporting. The Trump administration announced Thursday that it will prohibit fruit, candy, mint, and dessert flavors from small cartridge-based e-cigarettes popular with teenagers. Menthol and tobacco-flavored e-cigarettes will still be allowed to remain on the market. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said in a teleconference the administration hopes to cut down on nicotine addiction brought about through e-cigarette use.
Overwhelmingly prefer cartridge-based e-cigarette products, and the two flavors that we are not prioritizing, tobacco and menthol, are much less likely to be used by kids.
The ban does not cover larger tank-based vapes sold at specialty stores and used more by adults. In the latest government survey, more than one in four high school students reported using e-cigarettes in the previous month, despite a federal law that bans sales of the devices to those under age 18. For more, be sure to visit our website, voanews.com. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Suspected Islamist militants attack a convoy of Kenya passenger buses.
There was a bus that was ahead, it was fired at, then they stopped two others, but the one that they shot at was the one that was leading the rest. Then our officers came because the buses had the escort.
Analysts are optimistic about normal relations between Rwanda and Uganda in 2020. Uganda's parliament will begin vetting proposed cabinet ministers today, Friday. Malawian president and the main opposition leader trade competing New Year's messages, and anti-government protesters in Liberia demand a Monday protest, not Saturday.
We are not going to participate in what we believe is a violation of our constitution, whereby the government wants to assume authority that the constitution does not give it, which is to decide when citizens can feasibly assemble to protest.
Henry Costa is the leader of the Council of Patriots in Liberia, and a new voice app promises to be a game changer in tackling illiteracy and boosting local businesses in Mali. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's Pulse are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan security forces on Thursday launched a manhunt in coastal Lamu County after suspected militants attacked a bus. Authorities confirmed at least three fatalities and three injuries as a result of the incident. Rayal Ombua reports.
Three people were confirmed dead after suspected Al-Shabaab militants spread bullets at a bus ferrying passengers from Mombasa to Lamu County at the Kenyan coast. The incident happened on the Lamu-Garsen Road in an area called Nyongoro, which is heavily forested on both sides of the road. Lamu County Commissioner Irungu Masharia confirmed the fatalities and said three others also were injured in the attack and transferred to nearby health facilities. Speaking to VOA, Masharia said police have yet to establish the identity of the attackers.
There was that attack on the road. They attacked a bus along Malindi Ramu Road. Yes, they fired at the bus and he lost three lives. That one, you can't verify, unless the claim responsibility. But as far as we know, they could be bandits or anybody else. They could even be those terror groups or anything, but we cannot say for sure who they were.
He said the bus that was attacked was in the company of two other passenger buses and had a police escort, hence the quick response by the security personnel.
There was a bus that was ahead, it was fired at. Then they stopped two others, but the one that they shot at was the one that was leading the rest. Yeah, then our officers came because the buses had escort. So the officers came and responded to the distress and the attackers ran away. But we are searching for them in the forest.
Masharia says the attackers numbered about 10. Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for previous attacks on vehicles traveling between Lamu and Mombasa. Most cars and buses using the road now travel with a security escort, which is a government requirement. Masharia says the government is in pursuit of Thursday's attackers.
We have an operation in the forest trying to see whether we can get the bandits, but at least the operations on the road have returned to normal. We have escorted the buses and traffic is flowing.
In 2011, Kenya sent its troops to fight Al-Shabaab in Somalia. The Islamist militant groups began launching attacks in Kenya soon after. The militants have built a cross-border network, radicalizing and recruiting youth to fight in Somalia and carrying out attacks within Kenya. The largest attack, an assault on Garissa University College in 2015, killed nearly 150 people. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Political analysts and legal experts say they are optimistic that relations between Rwanda and Uganda can be normalized in the new year. Their hopes follow a recent visit to Rwanda by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's special envoy. After the talks with Rwandan President Paul Kagame, the two sides said the discussions were successful. Yuji Uwimana has details from Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
Political analysts based their hopefulness about Uganda-Rwanda relations in the new year on the principle that there are no permanent enemies in international relations and that a nation's foreign relations are determined by its national interests. This is Frank Mwine.
He says there is presidential elections next year in Uganda, and also in Rwanda, border crossings have been severely affected. That is why it is in the interest of the two governments to restore normal relations.
Based on recent developments in Uganda-Rwanda relations, it appears that the two countries already normalized their relations. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni recently sent his special envoy to Rwandan President. Ambassador Donia Ayebale's message was not disclosed, but Uganda said discussions were fruitful. For his part, President Kagame said what is important is to implement the agreement. He says, I don't doubt that we all want peace, whether we love each other or hate each other. After all, we need peace to do what everybody needs. Museveni sent an envoy, yes, but whenever we get time, we show them where we stand and ask them to do what they have to do to solve the matter. What Rwanda wants is for Uganda to effectively implement the Luanda Memorandum of Understanding signed by the two presidents in Angola last September. Rwanda wants Uganda to stop harboring and supporting anti-Rwanda forces and to fairly treat innocent Rwandans in Uganda who it says have been illegally detained. On the other hand, Uganda accuses Rwanda of planting spies on its sovereign soil. Ugandan Foreign Minister Sam Kutesa says his country will continue to do its part in bettering relations with Uganda.
The point is that we have nothing to benefit in destabilizing Rwanda, just like I think we have nothing to benefit by destabilizing Uganda.
On the other hand, Rwanda says what is needed is not rhetoric or commissions and meetings, but the goodwill of changing the situation. Olivier Nduhungirehe is Rwanda's state minister in charge of the East African community. He was addressing the media after a failed meeting in Kampala last December.
We don't need to multiply our meetings. We don't need to create commissions and or to create this and that. We need just to solve, to have good will, good faith, to solve the issues that our people are asking about.
According to reports by both countries, thorns in Rwanda-Uganda relations have been there for so long, despite being friends for decades. Relations deteriorated in these past 2 years, resulting in the closure of the two countries' borders and paralyzing trade and other social affairs. Museveni and Kagame say they don't want to destabilize each other's government in this new decade, which began January 1st this year. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Uganda's parliament will begin vetting proposed cabinet ministers today, Friday, according to the leader of the opposition in parliament, Betty Ayo Ocha. In a recent cabinet reshuffle, President Yoweri Museveni nominated 10 new ministers. Critics say the vetting process appears to be a sham, since the parliamentary committee that's carrying out the process is dominated by staunch members of the governing National Resistance Movement, or the NRM. Supporters of the ruling party have rejected the accusation. Opposition parliamentary leader Betty Ayo Ochan spoke with viewers Peter Clotty about the vetting process.
This vetting on Friday is usually about their papers, and in case some of them have issues from their areas, those issues come out. So they have to appear before appointment committee. Appointment committee looks at their original papers, if they are properly qualified, and if there is no complaint, then they are usually given the go-ahead. The fact that they are in parliament is already a clear evidence that they are qualified to be ministers. But somehow, sometimes, there are some issues.
But some people are saying that since majority of these are newly appointed ministers come from parliament, the vetting might not be as rigorous as people would want it to be, and that it could just be a rubber stamp for President Museveni to have the people that he appointed as ministers.
Yes, they are right to make that observation because of what has always been happening sometimes. You know, sometimes he says, what can we do? The appointing authority has said. So that is also there, although I cannot just dismiss that it is a rubber stamping, because at least I know of four that we stood our ground and said no. One, appointment committee consists of mainly the NRM. So NRM feared to say no to what the president has proposed.
If the committee in parliament consists mainly of members of the NRM, then the process isn't as rigorous as one would think. What do you make of it?
Well, I still say that it is an elective process in Uganda, which makes it very difficult for people to send people of their own choices. People who go there are mainly people who are pro-Museveni, and so those who are pro-Museveni cannot oppose him. So it is difficult. But if complaint comes from the ground, then at least we stand together. If there is no complaint from the ground, all those people will just appear for the sake of appearing.
What role do you think your opposition can play in this vetting process so Ugandans will have confidence that the opposition is fighting hard for them and making sure that these ministers are thoroughly vetted?
One, for us as opposition, we look at the papers and we look at the complaints, if in case complaints are there, and we question them. But we are still the minority voice. And as a minority voice, they always also take our concerns.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 3rd. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Malawian President Peter Mutharika has promised what he called a remarkable economy in 2020. The economy, which depends largely on foreign economic assistance and individual donor nations, suffered a setback between 2013 and 2016 when donors halted direct budget support because of concerns about corruption. In a New Year's message to the nation, President Mutharika said the economy is back on track due mostly to donor confidence. Mgemi Kalilani, a spokesperson for Malawian President Peter Mutharika.
The president painted a very promising picture of the economy. He started by looking at where we started. You remember one very interesting point in terms of Malawi's recent economic history is what happened to the economy post the cascade. You recall very well the cascade triggered a number of reactions from the international community. Our financing partners, most of them pulled out of Malawi on the basis of the cascade scandal. So the president informed the nation that we have made quite a lot of progress in that aspect. Our financial relationship with the international community has been amended, and we have seen quite a number of international institutions coming back to work with us, having been assured that we have cleaned up the mess, and we continue to be vigilant and to be prudent in terms of economic management.
As you said, these donors left or withdrew because of the corruption, as you mentioned. What progress? Let's be specific.
Well, there's been a lot of progress. You know, coming from the cascade cases, a number of cases that came from there have been taken through the court process, and the Anti-Corruption Bureau has registered quite a remarkable success rate. I think at this point in time, more than 95% of the cases that they took to court have been successfully prosecuted, and they have ended up in the ACB, the Anti-Corruption Bureau, securing conviction on all those cases. I'm putting 95 because I'm just being economic about it. It should be around 100% success rate. And that has been very impressive, both locally and we assume that international as well, because we know that our international partners have been following us in that area. So that's just one example of how committed the Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika's government is to fighting corruption.
Mgemi Kalinani is spokesperson for Malawian President Peter Mutharika. You're speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Anti-government protesters in Liberia say they will not accept a Saturday protest day as proposed by the Liberian government. Henry Costa is founder of the Council of Patriots, organizers of the proposed protest in Liberia.
We are not going to participate in what we believe is a violation of our constitution, whereby the government wants to assume authority that the constitution does not give it, which is to decide when citizens can peaceably assemble to protest. And so the date that we want is the date that we insist that we be allowed to assemble on, and we demand that our government provide us security. And so on Monday, January 6th,
hundreds of thousands of Liberian citizens to assemble in a peaceful fashion to petition the government. The country is in a worsening state, things are worsening by the day. The president and his people seem to not be in touch with reality.
But Henry, what difference does it make whether the protest takes place on Saturday, January 4th or on January 6th? What difference does that make? In fact, someone would say that if you have the protest on January 4th, which is the Saturday, you are likely to get more people.
No, sir. The difference is that the government should not. And in our country, the government does not dictate to the citizens when to assemble. It is the citizens that write and inform the government when they want to assemble. If we comply with what the government wants, this will be the second time we are complying with what is up. Therefore, we don't want to do that. The international community asked us to not do the protest on the 30th of December. We call it off. We listened. Now the government wants to run us around, and we don't want to do that. Because to do that would mean we are now giving the government authority over us that the government should not and does not have. That is the difference, sir.
You mentioned the international community asking you to postpone the December 30th protest. It seems there's been some kind of, you now have an independent Council of Patriots. You are the Council of Patriots. Now, someone in the independent Council of Patriots have said that you call off the December 30th protest because you received money from the government.
Well, sir, there is no such thing as the independent Council of Patriots, sir. There is only the COP, which was founded by us. The only reason why we did not do the protest on the 30th is because the international community stepped in and said, look, we want you to exercise the constitutional right. We want to make sure you do it when the state provides you security.
Henry Costa is the founder of the Council of Patriots, organizers of the proposed protest in Liberia. He's speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. The surge in Africa innovation is expected to continue in 2020 with all sorts of solutions to the continent's problems. One example is an innovation created by a Malian in 2019. It's a voice control app that entrepreneurs are using to market their goods and services to customers who cannot read. VOA correspondent Maria Mandialo reports.
Ada Tambali is among a number of entrepreneurs who didn't get a formal education but found a new and easier way to do business with the help of an app.
Here are your lovely fruits. We have nice ripe oranges, apples, bananas, without forgetting to mention the pineapples. Today we have almost everything to keep you satisfied. To find us, go to the third bridge and you will see me.
Armed with a smartphone, she attracts clients by sending an audio message in Bambara with her location, as well as photographs of the goods she has available. She says the Lenali app is user-friendly for someone like her.
I installed it myself because Lenali has Bambara, Soninke, and almost all the languages.
Developer Mamadou Goro Sidibe, an IT engineer from Mali, says he wanted to serve people who couldn't read or write, as well as help those who need to share information in French but have not gone to school to learn it.
A lot of people get applications installed for them because they can't do it themselves. So it was with that in mind that we created vocal guides, vocal instructions in the local language, so people can understand what they are doing.
Sidibe says simple things such as setting up a profile can be challenging for some.
If you know how to write, you can put it in writing, and if not, you speak into the application and record it. And after that, you can publish vocally, you can comment vocally, and really you can do everything in this application without ever having to write a single word.
Most small business owners in Mali relied on friends, family, and word of mouth to keep them going. For Boubacar Sidiki Koita, who owns a motorbike shop in Bamako, the app has been a game changer.
Since I've been using Lenali, my turnover has gone up. Now I can sell 20 motorbikes a day, whereas before it was hard work selling just 5 a day.
According to the United Nations, only one-third of Malians are literate. Sidibe says the free app, available since January 2017, has a little over 73,000 users and is expected to become profitable when it reaches 200,000 users. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
It is 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with a review of some of the top moments we covered on Daybreak Sports in 2019. The year 2019 got off to a great start for Liverpool and Egypt star striker Mohamed Salah in January 2019, when he was named as the Confederation of African Football Player of the Year, the second consecutive year he has won the award. The 26-year-old Egypt forward Mo Salah beat Liverpool teammate Sadio Mane of Senegal and Arsenal and Gabon striker Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang to the title.
The winner is Mohamed Salah.
This award for me is always, I always say this award for me is very big. I love it because I saw it when I was young. I had a dream to win it one day. So now I won it twice and I'm very proud to win it twice.
In July, Algeria's national football team ended a 29-year dry spell to triumph at the African Cup of Nations for a second time. The North African side beat Senegal 1-0 in the final in Egypt's capital, Cairo. Sports journalist Ferdinand Ubum and Opeyemi Akiode reflect on the 2019 Nations Cup.
I would have been surprised if Algeria had not won the Nations Cup. They had the best team spirit. They played the most spectacular brand of football right from the first round.
I think the key moment also for me had to look at the numbers of African coaches at that particular Nations Cup. Maybe aside of Nigeria that had a foreign manager in general.
Another high point for African sport we covered on Daybreak Africa Sports in 2019 was the Rugby World Cup, where South Africa claimed their third Rugby World Cup with a historic 32-12 win over England in Japan. Captain of the South African national rugby team, the Springboks, Siya Kolisi, also made history as he became the first black man to captain the Springboks and first black man of any country to captain his side to World Cup glory. Siya Kolisi devoted the triumph to the people of South Africa with a grateful and gracious speech, preaching unity for the still divided nation.
To have a team like this, you know, we come from different backgrounds, different races, and we came together with one goal and we wanted to achieve it. I really hope that we've done that for South Africa to show that we can pull together if we want to work and we achieve something.
In athletics, Olympic gold medalist South Africa's Caster Semenya endured one of the most difficult years of her career in 2019. Earlier in the year, Semenya was faced with a challenge after a court of arbitration for sports in Switzerland ruled in favor of the International Association of Athletics Federations' proposed regulations regarding athletes with differences of sex development. And that's a wrap of the major highlights of 2019 Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend, and we look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Kenyan security forces on Thursday launched a manhunt in coastal Lamu County after suspected militants attacked a bus. Authorities confirmed at least 3 fatalities and 3 injuries as a result of the incident. And anti-government protesters in Liberia say they will not accept a Saturday protest day as proposed by the Liberian government. The protesters say it is their constitutional right to protest whenever and wherever they want to. That is it for this Friday, January 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.